Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Kim Dvorak, D-V-O-R-C-H-A-K, attorney for the Colorado Juvenile Defender Center. My attorney registration number is 26795, and I represent the juvenile in this case, who I will refer to as K-A-O. The ultimate...
Excuse me just a minute before you start. I forgot to mention one thing, that since this is a juvenile case, and I know you're using the juvenile's initials, we are being broadcast on the internet, and so if there's anything that's sensitive, please take that into account.
Thank you. The ultimate question before this court is whether children accused of crimes are entitled to the same legal standards as adults, and if there should be a difference in those standards, that they bear some rational relationship to the purpose of the Children's Code. In this case, KAO was adjudicated a juvenile delinquent on insufficient evidence. He entered a plea to a third adjudication with an attorney, following his father's concerns that that attorney had not provided effective assistance at trial, and he received a sentence that violates due process under the mandatory juvenile offender statute and is manifestly unreasonable and unconstitutional. I would like to start with the last claim, which is with respect to the mandatory sentencing statute, essentially a three strikes you're out statute for juvenile offenders. This issue, admittedly, is unpreserved in the trial court below, but will ultimately require resolution by this court or a higher court when it is raised in post-conviction review in this case or in another case.
Pardon me, Ms. Dvorak. Because it wasn't raised below, you would agree that we should apply the plein air standard of review to your issue now?
Yes, I would.
Okay, thank
yes,
you.
I would. And I would also suggest that in the interest of justice, we have a young man who is facing not only removal from his home, but incarceration of a minimum of 1 to 2 years.
It's actually, isn't he being assigned to the Division of Youth Corrections?
Yes. The Division of Youth Corrections is, as this court has recognized, I believe, in the JRS decision, what would be the analogous sentence to the Department of Corrections for adults.
But it's not adult imprisonment.
It is not an adult, no. It is a juvenile sentence which involves a secure incarceration facility.
Did the court actually make a finding that he was a mandatory sentence offender?
Yes, it did.
Where is that? I have not seen it in any judgment or anything. I know he talked about how, he talked about it a lot, but I'm just curious if you, it's your position he did make the finding. I don't want you to spend a lot of time looking for it, but I did not find that in the record.
Okay, I'll take a look during the
sure.
People's argument and try to raise that on rebuttal. What was imposed in this case was a mandatory sentence for KAO's second strike, not his third adjudication. His third adjudication may have been third in time, but it was actually second in occurrence. There were two offenses committed within the same week. The case in which KAO was adjudicated for the second time was 13JD16. That case happened after the adjudication that was considered the third adjudication in 13JD18. Essentially, I'm asking this court to overrule JCP 151 P3rd 635. In that case, the Court of Appeals rejected any analogous case law to the People v. Knees decision, the Colorado Supreme Court decision with respect to the adult habitual sentencing statute. And in the Knees decision, the Colorado Supreme Court referred to the deterrent purpose of a three strikes you're out, of a habitual sentencing statute.
Didn't the court also in the Knees case talk about the actual language of the statute, which is very different from the language in this statute? In this statute, there's no reference to when the offenses were committed, whereas in the habitual offender statute, it does turn on that term, or it did at the version it was in at the time. How can we I understand your argument that, gee, it seems only fair that it be the same, but you're asking us to hold the statute unconstitutional because we would be ignoring the plain language if we adopted your interpretation.
And, Your Honor, I believe that the plain language of the statute leads to an absurd result, and that that is not the purpose of statutory interpretation in this state. The absurd result would mean that children can be punished more severely than adults, and that children are provided less notice and less due process when it comes to repeat juvenile offender statutes than adult offenders are. And I don't believe that is the purpose of the Children's Code.
Well, if he were subject to the Habitual Offender Act and he had been found an habitual offender, I think he had a maximum of 4 years that he'd be in prison. So he would be in prison for 16 years. In this case, he got 2 years probation with a suspended sentence of 2 years. So how do you figure it makes it more severe for him to be treated as a juvenile than as an adult?
Because of the lack of notice. Because in the adult statute, it states that each conviction must precede the next conviction. You must be sentenced on the first before you can be considered habitual on the second, and so for the third. Here, our current case law in Colorado states that it is, in essence, doesn't matter when these things happen, that they can happen in any order, and really, we do not require that children receive any notice that they are going to be facing these enhanced penalties. And I think that's the distinction, is that KAO had no ability after his second adjudication to change his conduct, to change his ways, to personify that deterrent value in habitual sentencing statutes, because he was promptly sentenced as a habitual mandatory juvenile offender after that.
And he was found a juvenile delinquent earlier in 2012, right?
Correct.
So at that point, he had notice that he, if he committed two more, if he was adjudicated twice more, he would be subject to the mandatory sentence offender statute, right?
No, there is no notice of that in the record.
There's notice. He's presumed to know the law, just like he knows he shouldn't commit theft or commit assault, right?
Well, I don't know that we presume that children will know the sentencing law in our Children's Code in this state, but I think that typically what should have happened is that the trial court should have advised him at some point that he was facing these mandatory penalties, and that's what never happened.
And it did, actually. Before he pled guilty to the third one, the court very carefully talked to both him and his father and made sure they understood the consequences of the plea. So I don't think it's fair to say he didn't give notice at all. Do you?
Well, but it was with respect to an act that had occurred prior.
I see. So under your construction of the statute, if I'm not talking hypothetically, a juvenile were to commit, say, 10 crimes of whatever severity in a fairly brief period of time, he would not be subject to the mandatory sentence offender, right?
Well, there are other juvenile sentencing consequences that child could be sentenced to, the repeat sentence offender as well.
Okay, but under your...
Yes.
Isn't that kind of an absurd result? Wouldn't we be giving an absurd result if we adapted your construction of the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because it's how we adopt the adult statute. It's how we construe the adult statutes. So I don't think that we should give children any less protections and process than we give adults in the adult sentencing statutes.
Okay.
Ms. Dvorak, understanding that back when Mies was decided, the habitual criminal statute could result in life in prison. And at that point, the statute then said, it is important for you, Mr. Defendant, to count sequentially. One, then two, then three. Now, as my colleagues pointed out, the juvenile statute does not require sequential counting. It simply says once you get to three, whether it's 1-3-2 or 2-1-3, how you get there, that's it. And as my colleagues also pointed out, the juvenile was not looking at the sort of heavy, heavy sentence that was possible when Mies was decided. So I'm having trouble understanding how your client was disadvantaged compared to a defendant at the time of Mies who might end up in prison for the rest of his or her life.
Well, I think that needs to be taken in context of the fact that we're talking about a child and that we're talking about a completely different code of conduct, the children's code. I think that for a child being taken out of their home, being placed in a facility, being incarcerated, even if it's for 24 months, to that perspective of that child could feel, in fact, like the rest of their life, and that everything is proportional, whether it is coming from the viewpoint of a child, which is now what the Supreme Court is arguing in cases like JDB versus South Carolina, that we have to consider these things through the eyes of a reasonable child. And through the eyes of a child, if you look at the sentence that it was imposed in this case, which was stacked unreasonably and designed to get to the end result, which was to incarcerate this child, that this was a child who had actually been making progress from the time of the incidents for which he was tried to the date of his sentence, and that that progress was almost deliberately obstructed by the sentence by the court, by the imposition of the mandatory sentencing, and by the litany of requirements on pages 24 and 25 of my opening brief, which no child, unless they are in residential 24-hour care, could satisfy all of those requirements. And so I think this case deviates from the purpose of the Children's Code.
Okay, if I may interrupt one more time, and then I'll shut up. How can we conclude that this error is obvious in light of the fact that JCP, as I remember correctly, was in existence when this child was sentenced? And isn't that one of the hurdles under plain error review that you have to overcome?
Yes, Your Honor. And what I would state about JCP is that it doesn't provide the why. It doesn't provide the purpose. It merely states that we have two systems of justice and we don't have to apply these principles of deterrence equally. But it doesn't state what the rational relationship of that distinction is to a child or to the Children's Code. And so I think that JCP does not provide enough guidance to courts. It does not provide the rationale for treating children differently than the Nies decision, and that it, in fact, leads to an absurd result where children are treated more harshly than adults. I will reserve the rest of my 3 minutes after the state. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jacob Lochran, registration number 40904, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. As defense counsel addressed the fourth issue raised in her brief, the mandatory sentence offender provision, I'll focus on that in my response, but I am able to answer questions on any of the other issues if the court is curious about any of those. Section 19.2.516 sub 1 of the Children's Code mandates that a mandatory sentence offender is any juvenile who has been adjudicated a juvenile delinquent twice before and is now receiving a third adjudication. There is no language in that statute that requires that third adjudication to be a subsequent act or to have occurred after the first and second delinquent acts. Simply that it is a third and that it has been, he's being sentenced as a third offender. Here, the court did discuss the mandatory sentence offender provision when it was sentencing the juvenile. Discussed it at length, both counsel accepted that it applied to this case, and the court proceeded forward as if it applied to this case when it imposed a suspended sentence to the Department of Youth Corrections of 12 months to 24 months. In JCP, a division of this court already rejected the exact argument the defense counsel is making today. In that case, this court found that the language of the habitual offender provision that was addressed in Nies is different than the language addressed in the mandatory sentence offender provision at issue here. The habitual sentence offender provision has a date requirement. It says the two prior convictions must be within the preceding 10 years, and the third act must be a subsequent act. The language of the mandatory sentence offender provision does not have that mandatory subsequent act language. Simply that a third adjudication has occurred.
Is there an equal protection argument problem, counsel, when the adults are treated in this sense more leniently than juveniles?
I wouldn't say that it's more treating more leniently, and I would focus more on the plain language of the statutes. The reason there is a divergence between Mies and JCP is the plain language of the statute. The legislature has the prerogative to decide whether they want to treat adults one way and juveniles another. And the reason they may have done so here is the exact reason identified by Your Honors in questioning defense counsel. And that's that the consequences of a habitual offender sentence for an adult can, in many instances, be years upon years upon years, if not life sentences, for all practicality. And the juvenile system, as is shown in this case in particular, the worst consequence that a juvenile could face is 24 months in the Department of Youth Corrections. The juvenile in this case didn't even receive that. That sentence was suspended. He simply received a probationary sentence. So the equal protection argument, I think, fails to that extent. The habitual criminal penalties vastly exceed anything that's possible for a mandatory sentence offender under the Children's Code.
Could the trial judge have given the same sentence in the absence of reaching the mandatory sentence offender conclusion?
A sentence to the Department of Youth Corrections suspended with probation?
12 to 24 months.
Certainly. There's nothing to indicate he wouldn't have given that sentence if there hadn't been the discussion of the mandatory sentence offender. I think Your Honor did identify that. I don't know that the court ever made the exact finding that the mandatory sentence offender provision was being applied here, but it certainly was discussed amongst all the counsel, and the people wouldn't challenge that it was in fact applied here. Based on JCP, the people would ask this court to stay consistent with that longstanding precedent and well-reasoned precedent and find that the defendant's challenge fails here. If the court has no further questions on that or any of the issues, the people would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Please, the court, Your Honor. I did look at the record in this case, and I would believe that the transcript dated November 20th, 2013, on page 10, beginning on lines 19, would in fact be a finding by the court that the mandatory sentence offender statute does apply in this case, for the record.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, I realize we did not get to the people's, to the other claims in the brief, and that the people did not argue the other issues in this appeal. I am certainly in no way waiving those other arguments, but I think what I would suggest to the court is that they follow a similar theme, and that when we are looking at the juvenile procedures, the juvenile rules, that if we are relaxing those rules, if we are holding children to a different standard, such as the sufficiency of evidence, such as the competency of counsel, that there should be a valid reason for that. And that in this case, there is no valid reason, that there was insufficient proof. And I would give an example that when the counsel raised that the people had not proven identity in this case, the trial court said, well, if this is not KAO, then he can leave. That certainly is not appropriate finding of the people's burden of proof, which is beyond a reasonable doubt in a juvenile case. Also, with respect to the trial court's failure to make an inquiry regarding KAO's father's concern about the performance of his son's attorney, the trial court outright dismissed that claim. And I would say that at a minimum, this case should be remanded to the trial court for a hearing on the basis for the child's father's dissatisfaction with his attorney. There certainly is evidence in the record that there was a breakdown in communications. That bench conference started between the lawyer and the judge at the bench. Then the father's concerns were dismissed as untimely, and the discussion ended with the counsel moving to withdraw. I think there's ample evidence in the record that at a minimum in this case, a hearing is required to determine what the basis of the father's dissatisfaction with his son's attorney was. And in conclusion...
Excuse me, counsel, there was never a motion filed, though, and there was that colloquy on the final day of trial right before the defense rested, but after that, there was never any motions filed, and in fact, the juvenile and his father appeared in three further hearings with the same counsel, and there was no suggestion that there was a breakdown, was there?
There was no suggestion that there was a breakdown in the context of the plea in 13 JD 18, and in that proceeding, the trial court itself did not raise the issue of you all had raised this concern regarding the performance of counsel previously. There was no notice given to the father that that was the moment in which he had to raise his concern with respect to 13 JD 16. So what I would say is that that discussion took place in the plea colloquy in 13 JD 18, and in no way was the parent put on notice that he was waiving an objection to counsel in 13 JD 16. And at the end of the trial, there was no direct colloquy between the court and the parent regarding the need to file a motion. There was a colloquy between the attorney, but the parent was never notified by the judge specifically or given an opportunity to respond on the record. There is nothing in the record that shows the parent understood that the court was making it his burden to file this motion, when in fact, I would argue it was the court's burden to address the issue timely during the trial itself. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you, counsel, also for your excellent arguments. Those arguments and your briefs will be very helpful to the court in reaching an opinion. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused. Thank you.